Fluoride science is corporate science. Fluoride science is DDT science. It's asbestos science. It's tobacco science. It's a racket.
In July of 2004, Christopher Bryson sat down and discussed the findings of his new book, The Fluoride Deception, with Paul Connett of the Fluoride Action Network. The Fluoride Deception was published by Seven Stories Press in May of 2004. The book is based on nearly 10 years of research by Bryson, an award-winning journalist and former producer at the BBC. In this interview, we asked Bryson to introduce us to some of the important individuals and institutions which have played a role in shaping public policy on the toxicity of fluoride and the purported safety of the controversial water fluoridation program.
In 1993, I was working at Rockefeller Center in New York as a radio producer for the BBC. And I got a call from London. There was a local water fluoridation battle in the north of England, in Leeds. And the producers, it was a daytime radio show, You and Yours was the name of the program. And the producer said, Chris, what do you know about fluoride? What do the Yanks think about fluoride? Is there an American angle? And it was a very, you know, a familiar request to me. Is there an American angle to the story? And I said, look, I don't know fluoride from a hole in the wall. I have no idea about fluoride, but let me make a few phone calls and see if I can't help you out. And my first call was to Ralph Nader in Washington. And I'm not sure why I called Ralph Nader, but look, it was a consumer issue. And Mr. Consumer, Ralph Nader, I thought, let's give him a call. And I got through, and he said, look, I don't know a great deal about water fluoridation, but I've never had terribly good feelings about it. Here are the names of a couple of scientists you ought to speak with. And he gave me the names of Dr. William Hersey, who then and now is a chemist at the Environmental Protection Agency, and Dr. Robert J. Carton. Bob Carton had been with EPA, but at that time was then over at the U.S. Army. And I went down to Washington and met with Dr. Hersey and Dr. Carton, and they explained to me that the safety standards for water fluoridation in this country were based and are based on fraudulent science. Fluoride defenders will say there's two stories. There's the industrial story and there's the dental story, and ne'er the twain shall meet. It's not true. The stories are braided very tightly and very profoundly, and they're braided from the beginning. The very first suggestion that fluoride be added to public water supplies was made by a researcher, Gerald Cox, at the Mellon Institute in Pittsburgh. Cox became interested in fluoride because of the suggestion of Francis Freire. That's the letter I uncovered. Francis Freire is the director of the aluminum laboratory for the Aluminum Company of America. He is very concerned about fluoride pollution around aluminum plants. He's very concerned about what the fluoride is doing to the workers inside these aluminum plants. But his suggestion to Gerald Cox is to look at fluoride's dental effects. And it's upon the basis of that suggestion that Gerald Cox makes his proposal to add fluoride to public water supplies. Right at the very source of the stream, you find the aluminum industry. Cox's suggestion that we add fluoride to public water supplies needs to be understood for who was saying it and where he was saying it and what the track record of the Mellon Institute was. The Mellon Institute was a leading defender of asbestos for the asbestos industry. You know, today, industry are facing a tidal wave, a crippling tidal wave of lawsuits from people who have had their health damaged, who've been killed by asbestos. Well, for generations, the Mellon Institute produced research that said that mesothelioma was caused by something other than asbestos. That's how you have to understand the fluoride issue. Industry was concerned about fluoride pollution and about lawsuits of a similar magnitude for fluoride pollution, so it's no coincidence that the Mellon Institute makes the first suggestion that fluoride be added to public water supplies. It's quite astonishing, Paul, the degree to which environmentalists have not been educated about fluoride. You know, and I'm a reporter. I'm not a scientist or a doctor. You know, I'm quoting documents. I'm citing lawsuits when I refer to fluoride as a major industrial air pollutant. In fact, the leading air pollutant in the aftermath of the Cold War. Those are not my words. That's not my opinion. That's a quantitative assessment by industry experts of the scale of the lawsuits they were facing. You know, the most notorious air pollution disaster in U.S. history was the Halloween air pollution incident in Denora, Pennsylvania, a mill town south of Pittsburgh, where a couple of dozen people and several thousand were injured because of effluents coming from a U.S. steel plant, which were trapped by a temperature inversion. In the aftermath of those deaths, a researcher, Philip Stadler, a chemist, Philip Stadler, investigated. He did blood analysis and he measured high levels of fluoride in the blood of some of the injured and the deceased. He published that data along with data which found high levels of fluoride in vegetation and a lot of other circumstantial evidence indicating fluoride poisoning. Sadler published his research in Chemical and Engineering News, but the Public Health Service came in and said that fluoride wasn't responsible. It was a mixture of air pollutants and bad weather that had caused the disaster. Well, I uncovered a memo, Paul, a memo from the Aluminum Company of America, in which they had secretly gotten blood from one of the deceased. And their measurements were almost exactly the same measurements that Philip Stadler found. Laundering fluoride's role in the Denora pollution incident is really emblematic for what has happened for the last half century, and an accounting for why environmentalists don't know their own history. Denora jump-started the environmental movement, but environmentalists don't know that Denora was almost certainly caused by fluoride. The book looks very hard at the role of a key scientist, Dr. Harold Hodge, in the fluoride debate. Dr. Harold Hodge, for most of the Cold War, was the leading scientific defender of the safety of low doses of fluoride and the beneficial effects of water fluoridation.
Dr. Harold Hodge, a distinguished toxicologist on the Rochester team, has carefully investigated the safety of fluoridation.
Well, to put it very simply, fluoride is safe at one part per million.
No scientist's word was trusted more by the health establishment than Dr. Harold Hodge when it came to fluoride. He was a very senior figure and operated at the highest levels for almost all of his scientific career.
This brings us back to the fundamental point. Fluoride is safe, and I think I can say in conclusion that there is no health hazard that justifies postponing water fluoridation.
Harold Hodge, we now know, was the a co-orchestrator of the human radiation experiments in which citizens in hospitals at Rochester and in Oak Ridge were injected with plutonium by scientists under Harold Hodge's direction.
And there's a whole book written about that.
That's right. We know about Harold Hodge in part because of the work of investigative reporters such as Eileen Welsom, who won a Pulitzer Prize for discovering the names of the people who had been injected with plutonium. Harold Hodge's name surfaced in that book and surfaced in the subsequent presidential inquiry into the human radiation experiments. You join the dots. If Harold Hodge and the University of Rochester are injecting people with plutonium and uranium and at the same time they are reassuring us about fluoride safety, what's the connection?
So what was the connection? Howard Hodge was the chief toxicologist of the Manhattan Project, the group of scientists and engineers who developed the atomic bomb in World War II and the early years of the Cold War. Hodge was responsible for investigating the toxicity of many of the chemicals used in the production of the atomic bomb, and one of the chemicals of major concern was fluoride.
The Manhattan Project needed enormous quantities of fluoride to make nuclear weapons, to make the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. So the Manhattan Project were concerned about fluoride toxicity. The documents that I uncovered with Joel Griffiths in the files of the Manhattan Project and the Atomic Energy Commission are very clear and very explicit. The toxicology department at the University of Rochester, which was under the direction of Harold Hodge, was asked to come up with medical information that could help the government in lawsuits in which the United States Army and the US government were being charged with fluoride pollution.
As has now been revealed by declassified government documents, the publication of scientific information collected by Atomic Energy Commission scientists such as Harold Hodge that could increase the chance of litigation against the bomb program by workers or downwind communities was forbidden. If water fluoridation was found to be harmful, then the US bomb program, as well as many other fluoride polluting industries, would have been open to massive litigation.
So there's not a hope that Harold Hodge would ever say that water fluoridation was dangerous or that fluoride in small doses was toxic. Because if Harold Hodge were to say that, it would have pulled the rug out from under the US Army and from under the project to build nuclear weapons. For people who know the history of medicine and science in this country, you know, the Kettering Laboratory was at one time one of the largest private laboratories dealing with issues of toxicity. It was a very well-funded laboratory, and its director, Robert Kehoe, was a very senior figure in the public health establishment. Today, we know Kehoe's name best for his career-long defense of the safety of adding lead to gasoline. Kehoe spent a professional lifetime from his pulpit at the Kettering Laboratory assuring the nation that lead added to gasoline was entirely safe. Of course, that's been thoroughly discredited. The toll of health injuries, of neurological injuries to children alone from adding lead to gasoline is almost incalculable. And you know, for that, we really can thank Dr. Robert Kehoe. He soldiered on lead's behalf for his professional lifetime, and he did so being paid by the Ethyl Corporation, who were the makers of tetraethyl lead. The same job that Robert Kehoe did laundering lead's image on industry's behalf, he did for fluoride. Kehoe, along with Harold Hodge, was a leading defender of fluoride safety in the workplace, and he also was a leading promoter of water fluoridation.
Robert Kehoe and the Kettering Institute, on behalf of industry and the National Institute of Dental Research, compiled an extensive bibliography of abstracts on fluoride's toxicity and the role of fluoride in public health. This work was funded by Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of Canada, the American Petroleum Institute, DuPont, Kaiser Aluminum, Reynolds Metals, United Steel, and many other corporate sponsors, as well as the National Institute of Dental Research.
If you go into the files of Dr. Robert Kehoe at the Kettering Laboratory, you'll come across the existence of a hitherto unknown entity known as the Fluorine Lawyers Committee. And Kehoe worked for the Fluorine Lawyers Committee at the University of Cincinnati, doing their bidding, providing ammunition to the Fluorine Lawyers Committee so that they could defend their corporate clients, Alcoa, DuPont, Monsanto, the U.S. Steel, against fluoride lawsuits. In Robert Kehoe's files, there is a medical study which was a state-of-the-art $100,000 study in which beagle dogs were given fluoride to breathe in conditions which approximated the working conditions for men and women in the aluminum industry or in any fluoride industry.
What happened to that beagle study?
The beagle study, Paul, found that fluoride was profoundly toxic to the laboratory animals. The beagle dogs, who breathed fluoride 6 days a week, just like workers, had stupendous lung damage and damage to their lymph nodes. You'd think that someone would have given that medical information to America's doctors or to the workers who were going to those doctors asking why they had emphysema. No, the study was given to the Fluorine Lawyers Committee and it was buried. The book makes clear for the first time that the selling of fluoride to the American public was done by the best in the business, by the father of public relations, Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays is Sigmund Freud's nephew, and he was a Machiavellian genius, small in size, yet cast a towering shadow over the 20th century. Bernays understood that there was a liberal sentiment coursing through the 20th century, and that if you could hitch your commercial wagon to that star, then you could make your clients a lot of money. In 1916, Bernays had suffragettes march in the Easter Parade in New York City holding cigarettes as torches of liberty. And he cooked up that scheme on behalf of the American Tobacco Company and its director, George Hill, who was paying Bernays's salary. While my book uncovers correspondence between Bernays and the National Institutes of Dental Research, Bernays was asked to come to Washington by the NIDR to help create their PR campaign to sell fluoride to the nation. Bernays understood that people have an unconscious trust in their doctor or their dentist, and if you can persuade doctors and dentists that fluoride is safe and good, then you're able to reach the rest of the nation. People believe they're doctors and dentists, and that was a way of promoting fluoride for Bernays. Very few dentists are aware that the fluoride in public water supplies is a pharmaceutical-grade product. It is in fact an industrial waste. It's the waste from the Florida phosphate industry. In the 1950s, the Florida phosphate industry was being sued by farmers and citizens living near those plants because of the fluoride that was killing their cattle, destroying their crops. You know, the Florida phosphate industry today is prevented from having to dispose of its industrial effluent in a toxic waste dump by the device of shipping that in tanker trucks around the country and dumping it in our water supply. From the beginning, opposition to fluoride has been equated with believing the earth is flat or being against the United Nations. Opposition to fluoride is equated with quackery or paranoia. And in fact, that's really a media smear. In 1950, the public health endorsed water fluoridation. Almost immediately, there was a national movement against fluoride, and that was led by Dr. George Wolbot. We should all know George Wolbot's name. He was the first physician to warn of the dangers of fatal allergic reaction to penicillin. Now, Wolbot was one of the first physicians to warn of the dangers of emphysema from smoking. He saw in his own surgery, in his practice in Detroit, Michigan, that people were coming in with these ailments, unexplained ailments, whether it was back pain or gastric distress, muscle fatigue, headaches, and he figured out that it was low-dose fluoride. That, as with a lot of drugs or chemicals, there's a small subset of people who are uniquely allergic to the chemical, and Wolbot realized that it was fluoride, and he performed a whole series of double-blind experiments where people were given fluoridated water without knowing it, and the symptoms recurred. And very quickly, Wolbot's name, rather than being seen as this giant of public health committed to safeguarding public health, somebody who'd warn us about penicillin or tobacco, suddenly George Wolbot becomes this marginal fringe figure who is criticized for his opposition to fluoride, and that's something that takes place again and again and again. Speaking out as a doctor or a dentist against fluoride is the third rail. It's fatal to your career. We don't know George Wolbot's name because he was smeared by the Public Health Service for his opposition to fluoride. In the 1990s, the senior toxicologist for the EPA's Office of Water said that the cancer tests that had been done on fluoride, where laboratory animals were given fluoride, he said that those results had been gerrymandered, that in fact the equivocal verdict that fluoride was a carcinogen ought to have been much stronger. He said that fluoride given to rats had produced bone cancer and liver cancer, and that those results had been doctored to make it look as though fluoride hadn't caused as much cancer.
I've been in the toxicology business looking at studies of this nature for nearly 25 years, and I've never seen that. Never ever seen where every single endpoint that was a cancer endpoint had been downgraded. I'd seen one or two endpoints argued over, usually on a definition of what is a cancer in that particular tissue, but I've never seen every one of them downgraded. I found that very suspicious.
Marcus was fired. Dr. William Marcus was fired, and a federal judge ruled that Marcus was fired because of his outspoken opposition to fluoride. The first two chapters of the book relate the story of Dr. Phyllis Mullenix at the Forsyth Dental Institute. She had helped invent a new technology for studying the neurotoxicity of chemicals. It was called a computer pattern recognition system. And in essence, Dr. Mullenix's technology took photographs or video of animals which had been given a chemical in small doses, and then used computers to analyze the patterned behavior or the disruptions to patterned behavior when the animals had been given that chemical. While Mullenix was brought into the Forsyth Dental Research Center to study some of the chemicals used in dentistry, and she was asked to study fluoride. And Phyllis Mullenix said, I'm not wasting my time with fluoride. Fluoride's given to children, it's good for children, it's been around for donkey's years. I'm wasting my time by studying fluoride. But she did as she was ordered. And Phyllis Mullenix found that fluoride in very modest doses produces effects in laboratory animals resembling attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder.
The pattern that we saw it typically is what we see with other neurotoxic agents that are well known to cause a hypoactivity or a memory problem or an IQ problem. When I first presented the results of these studies, one of the individuals sitting and listening to the results, he says, "Do you have any idea what you're saying?" And he says, "You're telling us that we're reducing the IQ of children." And basically I said, "Yes."
She went from being an industry-funded, leading neurotoxicologist at a Harvard-affiliated research institute to being a voice in the wilderness. She has not received any grants nor any academic position as a research scientist since her opposition to fluoride was made public.
The Center of Disease Control says that water fluoridation is one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. How can citizens deal with something like that?
Question authority. You know, for years and years and years and years, the public health establishment told us that lead in gasoline was safe. We know today that children's brains were damaged, were injured by the addition of lead to gasoline. The implications of this new documentary evidence, the implications of these buried medical studies which are now in the public domain as a result of my book, as a result of the medical work that's been done by people like Phyllis Mullenix, the willingness to speak truth of toxicologists like William Marcus, the implications of that research, of these new findings, is that something is terribly, terribly wrong. And we have been led very far astray, and it's time to change. But that change will only come as a result of bravery, as a result of the willingness to invest time. I think it's time to speak up, to speak loudly, to get organized, and to fight for change.